Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. In this episode of Family Office Real Estate Insights, we speak with Jimmy Atkinson, founder of Opportunity DB and Wealth Channel, on the current status of Opportunity Zones this March 2023. So welcome to another episode of Family Office Real Estate Insights. Today I have Jimmy Atkinson with Opportunity DB and Wealth Channel. Jimmy, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, DJ. Great to see you. Always a pleasure to speak with you. And thanks for inviting me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So when you started Opportunity DB, first off, let's backtrack here a little bit, because Opportunity DB is strictly all about opportunity zones, correct?
And that's
how
right.
did you yes. come about this whole thing? Because you did it a number of years ago. I know that I was like one of the first few people that you interviewed. But that's what I want to really cover today. So how did that all start?
Well, it started in the summer of 2018. I was kind of keeping my ear to the ground, looking for the next big thing, so to speak. I'm a serial entrepreneur, and I had had a few exits in some previous businesses that I had been involved with. And I was kind of between projects. And one day, at the end of July or the beginning of August of 2018, I was listening to a podcast episode, and it was a crash course in opportunity zones, which is a relatively, at the time, it was a relatively new and somewhat unknown piece of tax policy legislation that introduced what I refer to now as possibly the greatest tax incentive ever created: opportunity zones and qualified opportunity funds. And I listened to this podcast episode, and after an hour of listening to it, I went to the internet to do some more research to learn more about opportunity zones, because I thought, well, this sounds really cool. The ability to defer capital gains and eventually eliminate capital gains taxation on the appreciation of your subsequent opportunity zone investment. I want to learn more about it. And that's when I discovered there really wasn't a lot of information out there. And then a light bulb went off over my head, just like in the cartoons, right, DJ? And I decided then and there, let's start a website about this. I want to put together some content, learn as much as I can about it, and share what I've learned with as many investors and developers and other opportunity zone stakeholders as possible. And then that turned into opportunitydb.com, the website, which has a lot of tools and resources and data for anyone in the opportunity zones industry. But then a few months later, in November of 2018, I started the podcast. And DJ, if I recall correctly, you were episode number 3, and that episode's still available. If anybody wants to listen to that, they can go to opportunitydb.com/podcast, and we're up about 250 or so episodes now. So it's still going strong.
Well, when they came out, you know, it was all the rage, and everybody was talking about OZs. However, our government really didn't have everything in place, right? Mm-hmm. So there, we were still waiting on a ton of policies, a ton of information of exactly what they were. Once you, like you said, is that there was a big gap in really the knowledge and education that was being provided to understand, you know, what opportunity zones were, how they functioned, you know, timeframes, all this. In fact, I remember being, I was hosting a panel, and we were talking about opportunity zones, and there's various answers that were coming from one question that I had. And I literally said, this is exactly
you know, the problem today is that people are not really having an understanding. And in fact, you know, we do the largest family office real estate study actually in the world. We're starting our fifth year. And you know, there was never, especially the first couple of years, 20-25% of families were investing into OZs, and that was it. And I really contribute that to not knowing and understanding. So going back to when you started and, you know, those first couple years, tell me a little bit about what you saw as in that understanding as the changes were happening and the information was becoming more solidified.
Yeah. So I think there were two issues that you were trying to tackle there. One was it was a brand new policy program. So it just takes a while for the industry, and by that I mean the asset management industry, and in particular the real estate development and real estate investing industry, to kind of get up to speed with what this thing is. So the tax policy itself was passed as President Donald Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which he signed into law at the very end of 2017. But it wasn't until, I think it was about June or July of the following year, where the actual opportunity zones, the census tracts all around the country, were actually designated as federally qualified opportunity zones. So nothing happened for 7 months there, and nothing could happen in terms of the opportunity zone investment marketplace until those zones were locked in place. So once you got to about mid-July of 2018, that's when you could theoretically make an opportunity zone investment, but the vehicles needed to be set up first, the qualified opportunity fund. So now we had an available map of where the investment dollars could flow into, but the funds then had to get set up. And the two issues at play there were, one, again, it's a brand new policy program. It takes a while to digest the information and the ability to kind of get up to speed. And the industry had to learn how to set up a qualified opportunity fund, best practices. Then the other outstanding issue was a regulatory matter. The IRS and the Treasury Department, which oversees the IRS, hadn't come out with official rulemaking on what would qualify an opportunity zone fund, what constitutes a qualified opportunity zone business, a whole bunch of inside baseball type jargon that needed to be defined for the attorneys and the accountants to be able to actually execute the program. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, several hundred pages. I think the opportunity zones provision was maybe 5 or 6 pages of that legislation. And in that 5 or 6 pages, it loosely defined the letter of the law, what opportunity zones should do, what a qualified opportunity zone fund is, but the IRS had to interpret that and put rules around it. And that was a 2-year process. So the legislation was passed at the end of 2017. It wasn't until the end of 2019, after I think 2 IRS hearings and several rounds of initial regulations, when we finally got the final regulations from the IRS. And then right as the final regulations came out and the wheel started churning, then we ran into, about a year later, we ran into COVID and all the problems that posed for the world. So it's kind of been a start and stop type of project here for opportunity zones as an asset class.
You know, it's if you would think, first off, well, you'd understand why not, but you'd think that our government would get with the, you know, the two parties with the IRS would talk and make sure that they were on the same page, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's to me, that seems like it was very premature that they rolled it out, right? Because there's still a ton of information that needed to understand. So when you started those interviews before, let's say up till COVID, I mean, how many deals were you really seeing getting done? Because, you know, investors were having to make decisions. Do I want to invest in this? And if so, you know, we're still waiting on some of the final answers to come along. So what were you seeing at the time?
Yeah, some of the initial funds that I saw roll out really were the trailblazers. They were kind of, I guess there was a pro and a con to coming out with a fund early. You had first mover advantage on the one hand. Mm-hmm. So if you did have investors who were looking for an opportunity zone fund, there weren't a lot of players. It wasn't a very crowded field. And then, on the other hand, you didn't have final regs. So how could you be sure that you were adhering to rules that hadn't really been set yet? And I think there were in 2018, particularly in the latter half of 2018 and going into 2019, before the final regulations had been issued, the industry had kind of coalesced at least around some best practices. And there were some fund administrators who were setting up shop. There were some accountants and some attorneys who were starting to focus on qualified opportunity funds. And the industry was kind of forming right before our eyes, right, DJ, on how to do some of these things. And Novogradic, a professional services firm, accounting firm, put together a working group of professionals, and they helped disseminate information on what best practices should be in terms of setting up these entities into which investors could place their dollars. And they also had dialogue regularly with attorneys at the IRS to make sure that they weren't running afoul of anything that might pop up as a surprise later. So I think a lot of the preeminent fund managers and their accountants and attorneys were part of that working group. So that really helped when the industry was new. I would say that my first several dozen podcast episodes, I rolled that podcast out, the Opportunity Zones podcast, in November of 2018, more than a year before the final regs were issued. Probably the first year or so of podcast episodes dealt with policy in general. What should the policy be? What should the rules be? How will IRS interpret this part of the statute or that part of the statute? I had a lot of interviews with attorneys and accountants and some trailblazing fund managers, and we're all trying to figure it out. As the marketplace has matured, as we've gotten final regulations now in place for the last couple of years, I've actually been able to do interviews that feature more investors, more fund managers that have actually not just talked the talk, but they have now walked the walk. And we can look back and see, hey, this isn't what we're planning on doing or what we think we're going to do, but now we're looking back and we're able to see these are the buildings that we constructed. These are the businesses that we put into place in opportunity zones over the last couple of years. So that shift from what will be or what could be into what has been accomplished has been an interesting one to witness unfold over the last few years here.
Yeah, one of the things that I really found interesting when we went through those all the zones, right, was it 7,800? I think it was.
That's 8,764 to be precise. But sometimes I just say 8,700.
I got the 8 and 7 mixed up in the beginning. But you know what was amazing to me is that there was a lot of different zones, and there still are a lot of zones that you would ask the question, why is this an opportunity zone? You know. I was out in Las Vegas actually, and a friend of mine took me around, and we went to the old part of Las Vegas, and the founder of Zappos had started, making the area and revitalizing that whole area. Right. So it was already starting, and I'm looking and I'm like, okay, why is this an OZ? And then you've got places that are very well known in New York City that were OZs, you know, and being able to utilize those. So, you know, I would imagine that had a lot to do with the politics, you know, and who received what, but they would also be the most successful areas where people have built. Is that what you've seen? I mean, a lot of the investors in those prime areas companies, their sponsors, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a lot of the dollars that have flowed into opportunity zones have flowed into the top 10% of opportunity zones in terms of up and coming neighborhoods. Let's back up and let's talk about the nomination process. So the governor of each state, plus the governors of all of the territories, including Puerto Rico and Guam and the other territories, U.S. Virgin Islands, and the mayor of Washington, D.C., were each able to designate 25% of their low-income census tracts as qualified opportunity zones. There's a special carve-out to allow for 5 percentage points of that 25% to be deemed non-low income census tracts as long as they were contiguous with the low income census tracts, geographically speaking, and they had to meet a few other criteria. I don't remember all the details. It's quite wordy, all of the language that went into determining what's a low income census tract, what's a non-low income contiguous tract. But suffice it to say, DJ, yeah, you're absolutely right. The process did become very political. And this all unfolded in the spring of 2018, a few months after the legislation was passed, but before the zones were certified by the Treasury Department in July of 2018. In that intervening 6.5 month period, that is when all of these jurisdictions got to nominate the zones to the Treasury Department at the federal level. And different states did it differently. Some states knew that opportunity zones were coming. They had been following it for months, if not years beforehand, because it took a few years for opportunity zones to actually get packaged into a legislative vehicle in order for it to pass. Mm-hmm. Some people had their ear to the ground and knew it was coming, or knew there was a chance it was coming. So when the legislation was passed in December of 2017, some states already kind of had a plan on what they wanted to do. Others got caught by surprise. Others may not have found out about opportunity zones until weeks or months later. And then they had a rather rushed nomination process within their states or Washington, D.C., or the, I'll just call it jurisdictions going forward, the territories, mm-hmm. right? So the way that that process unfolded is, you can imagine if you were the governor of California, you might hear from different counties and different cities all across your state. Different cities may have known what was coming, and they already would have had a plan, or they could have quickly put a plan together in place. Other counties may not have had any idea what opportunity zones were and never even offered their nominations. So, and in fact, I'll even tell you this, DJ, I got emails years after the designation process had been completed. I haven't received one in a while, but even through 2021, I would say, DJ, I would get an email every once in a while from a representative from some economic development group in any town, USA, or some rural opportunity zone group in some state. I won't mention any names or any specific examples, but they would ask me, they would say, hey, I'd like to create an opportunity zone. How do I go about doing that? I want to make our community an opportunity zone. And I would have to tell them, well, unfortunately, that ship sailed 2, 3, 4 years ago. You would have had to nominate this up to your state governor's office years ago. And I think that's one of the unfortunate things that happened with opportunity zones, is the word didn't get out to the folks that it needed to get out to, oftentimes until it was too late. But then what you did see unfold, DJ, was different states did have different priorities. Some of them did push hard for already for areas that were already experiencing an uptick to get designated as zones. Others went the other direction. Some states kind of took a hybrid approach where they picked very downtrodden areas and a mix of downtrodden areas with those that were on the upswing. And if you look at the map and you study the areas, you will see a pretty good mix of both throughout, both in urban and in rural areas as well, DJ.
You know, I don't remember specifically the interview that I did with you, but I do know this, is that at the time, you know, I was sort of I wasn't as positive as others, you know, on the OZ, and saying, you know, I don't think this is going to happen or that's going to happen type of thing. Right. And one of the big things was that started to manifest. And I still think this is happening, especially in certain areas, is that you go in, you start developing, right? And so now you're building the buildings because you've really got to go ground up, and you're starting to bring in the multifamily, the retail, right? Maybe the supermarket, et cetera. Well, you're actually displacing the people that you didn't think you were going to displace, or that you weren't supposed to displace, right? And so because they can't afford to live there in those necessarily in those areas, have you seen that, or has that been a discussion that's come up? I mean, it depending on how big the opportunity zone is, I mean, you could literally build a whole brand new, you know, area, right? With all new product and there's no restrictions on what you can charge for rent or anything like that.
That's correct. Yeah. And that's one of the criticisms of the Opportunity Zones initiative is that oftentimes the projects that the federal government is incentivizing or basically subsidizing through these different tax incentives to construct are going to end up displacing the residents that the program is meant to help. And I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a real estate developer. I don't know what the best solution is to that. I will say this. I do believe that some social problems that exist in this country are very difficult to address and difficult to solve. And Opportunity Zones is not some panacea that's going to completely solve all of our social issues. And in some cases, it's going to make some problems worse. It will displace residents, absolutely, in some locations. In other locations, it might help quite a bit. It might help bring in more workforce housing and more job creation. I don't know what the end result is going to be for Opportunity Zones, but I suspect based on anecdotal evidence that I have heard is that at the end of the day, it will have done more good than harm. Of course, in some locations, that might not be the case.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that was very interesting is being able to identify what those benefits were, right? Jim Sorensen, who's he has an Opportunity Zone, a very big into social impact, right? And he came up with the first that I saw anyway that really identified, okay, here are the benefits, and or here's what we look for, sort of a scorecard per se, right? And since then, you know, Warren Buffett's grandson came up with an algorithm that's used by at least one of the fund administrators that I know that can quantify what the actual benefits are in those areas. But, you know, once again, I think that comes back to if you're in the top 10 areas, you're going to have somewhat different results than if you were in the bottom 10 areas or the next 10% areas, right? I mean, it's really going to be based upon, you know, what type of environment or area is around the opportunity zones, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you're right, DJ, there are a handful of different social impact oriented scorecards. You mentioned the one with Howard Buffett. I think they call it the IRR, impact rate of return, lowercase I, if I recall correctly. Yep. And JTC Americas is the fund administrator that uses that
that's
one.
Right.
They would love me name dropping them. So that's JTC Americas. Jim Sorensen at Catalyst Opportunity Funds has his scorecard. There's also the Beck Center out of Georgetown has something that they refer to as the OZ framework, which tracks impact. And I think what they're all getting at is they're trying to determine a large part of this is the policy is trying to increase the economic activity within these different zones. And maybe the best measure of that is jobs. How many jobs are being created as the result of this policy? And so that's one of the key metrics that goes into a lot of these different scorecards. And how many jobs are being created? I don't know that. It's too early to tell.
A lot of the data really
isn't available.
Yeah, I do know that anybody that does a hotel, that's where you're going to create the most jobs.
Yes.
Really, right? Because you have the construction jobs and then you have all those ongoing jobs that are happening within the hotel as well.
Well, I will also say, DJ, I think the most popular sector, real estate sector, is residential. And the vast majority of the residential is multifamily specifically. And I think depending on what type of multifamily you're constructing, it's not all affordable housing. Oftentimes it's market rate, but sometimes it's in that sweet spot of 70 to 130% AMI. What oftentimes people refer to as workforce housing.
Yep.
Building that workforce housing at least establishes that foundation for the amount of jobs that that community can bear, right? So I think that's a key component is building that multifamily housing in these areas. It doesn't always need to be an asset that creates jobs in and of itself, but it can be somewhere that can house the people who get employed in the job force in that area, right?
You know, what's interesting, look, if I come from a development perspective, I have my developer hat on there. Mm-hmm. I want to maximize my returns. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to maximize your returns by having market rate before you will have affordable housing, you know, just from what you're charging. And so that makes it, it's sort of, it's conflicting, right? Where you do want those affordable housing issues or opportunities, but then you also have the bottom line, you know, that, right. that just goes sure. and expands outside a whole nother conversation, which has to do with affordable housing issue, you know, in the States.
Yeah. Well, DJ, when I mentioned, by the way, when I mentioned workforce housing, that is market rate yeah. housing, but it's not meant to be luxury housing per se, but market rate workforce housing, I define that as market rate, but catering to the working class, nurses, firefighters, police officers, teachers, those yeah, types of folks, workforce housing, not below market rate, affordable housing that has to be subsidized.
But even when you go, when you're going on from a market, I'm saying your middle income, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. a little above that blue collar, I mean, the higher that you can go up the food chain that you're able to charge for rents is going to maximize the value, right? And that's what I was saying is if you have new product and you've got a whole little community you're starting to build, you know, then you can charge more for those.
Sure.
And so that is, once again, you know, it's sort of a confliction in some regards. So there's a bunch of different things that people can do within OZs that they weren't necessarily aware of at the time. I think a lot of people weren't as well. And you brought up one of them, which had to do with businesses, right? Being able to be in that area. Have you seen an increase in investments within OZs that have to do with other things than real estate? Or has it pretty much stayed the same since you started doing, you know, your podcast and the company that you built?
It's pretty much stayed the same, quite frankly. At the end of the day, this is a place-based tax policy, and mm-hmm. it is very simple to qualify a real estate project as a qualified opportunity zone business and then wrap it in a qualified opportunity fund that can receive investment dollars from outside investors. I really haven't seen a lot of cases of businesses or startups using this. Qualifying as a business for the purposes of opportunity zone investing is a little bit trickier. It's just kind of a different animal. The holding period oftentimes doesn't really line up. You need to hold these investments for 10 years or more in order to achieve the full tax benefit. And oftentimes that can be a deal killer if you're setting up a business. It just seems it's much simpler to do real estate. And I think that's why the vast, vast majority of qualified opportunity funds that I see invest solely in real estate. Now, that said, I have seen a couple of examples of some outfits that are investing into startup businesses or particularly tech businesses or patent protected businesses. Yes. So two groups I'd like to mention now. One is Len Mills has the Verte OZ Fund, which is predominantly focused along the Mid-Atlantic seaboard area. He's located himself in Maryland, and his portfolio has, I think, about maybe a dozen or so different companies that are receiving capital from his fund. One of them actually just signed a deal with Netflix the other day, I noticed. It was a media production company. And then another outfit in Provo, Utah, Hall Labs, has an accelerator campus, huge accelerator campus, where they have a portfolio of different companies that all have some sort of patent-protected technology behind them.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's one of the things that I zoned in. I mean, you know, I'm a real estate guy, but what I zoned in on, if I was a VC firm, mm-hmm. I would go out and buy a building. I would then be an incubator, right? And yeah. I'd bring in all these companies that would be housed there. In exchange for rent, I would say, give me some shares. So instead of paying, you know, $20,000 a month, you give me 10,000 worth of shares, you give me 10,000 worth of, you know, rent that's coming in that at least covers my mortgage. So even if I'm not making any profit on the real estate, you know, from a cash flow perspective, and we're pretty much breaking even, you know, you hit one of these companies, they hit it big. I mean, you're going to end up well and beyond, right? Of that. And then of course you have the value in the real estate as well, but as long as you, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't dove into to all these policies in quite a long time, but even if you did sell within that 10-year period of time, as long as you reinvest back into an opportunity zone, you're going to maintain that period, right? So let's say after 4 years. So,
yeah, I don't know the answer to that. It depends who you ask. It depends how the fund is structured, and depends how you circulate that cash within the fund. I would answer that's a little bit above my pay grade. I think it is possible though, but you have to do it just right.
You know, what's ironic is that here we are, you know, we're talking about 2018, not all the policies, people being confused, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Here we are in 2023 and we're like, well, I believe this is what the case is. And so those conversations are happening, which I still think, you know, is one of the reasons why the opportunity zone hasn't attracted as much money as a lot of people thought. I mean, I can tell you this is that there's definitely been some big check writers from families that have put money in. However, it seems to me like it's primarily your high net worth that's been putting money in to these OZs. Is that what you've heard, or that what you've seen? I mean, not the people that are worth hundreds of millions as much as the people that are worth, you know, millions.
Yeah. Well, I might be somewhat biased, but that seems to be our audience. That's why I'm biased.
Yeah.
Those seem to be the folks that we attract to our website and to our podcast are the high net worth investors, ultra high net worth investors, a few family offices also, I know, follow our show and follow our website. Yeah, that's primarily who we see attracted to opportunity zones. And that's really the audience that we've decided to cater to. And that's also one reason, by the way, DJ, why we are deciding to broaden our footprint outside of opportunity zones. OZ is still remaining a huge focus for us. But just in the last couple of months, we launched our new brand, which is called Wealth Channel, which is meant to be a community for high net worth investors and the advisors who serve them. We're trying to teach these types of folks, high net worths and ultra high net worth investors, how to protect and grow their wealth with tax advantaged alternative investments. And Opportunity Zones fits pretty cleanly into that bucket.
Yeah, I had a chance the other day with your partner, Andy Higgins. Mm-hmm. So we were talking
Love
about
Andy,
that.
Yep.
And, you know, it's you guys have it's been great to see your progression of what you're doing, you know, and some of the things that we were talking about was, you know, how alternatives have continued to increase in awareness and use. You know, over the last 10 years, it's been slow, but it's sort of been, you know, started from the ultra wealthy, and then it's sort of worked its way down where it's now becoming more of an opportunity for people more on the retail side or down at the other end. And so I think it's you know, you're getting outperformance and in the alts. And I personally think that the non-liquidity component is actually a benefit, you know. Similar to there are people that will complain about the 10-year period with the OZ, but it's like it's actually helpful for you so that you don't sell, right? Like a period of time that we've gone through and we're starting to see a rise in interest rates and some people unclear and everything like that. So
yeah, oftentimes, if I can just touch on that point before you move on, I totally agree, DJ. I think oftentimes investors can be their own worst enemy. If you have access to a brokerage account where you can buy and sell throughout the day, you can really get into trouble with that. This might sound counterintuitive, but if you pay too much attention to your brokerage account, you can actually get into trouble. It's best oftentimes to set it and forget it. Just long-term buy and hold strategy oftentimes ends up outperforming folks who are more actively trading. Because oftentimes you'll end up buying at wrong times, selling at wrong times, and then you incur transaction fees every time you turn over anything in your portfolio. So I think that's what you're getting at when you're saying the illiquidity can be a good thing and kind of protect you against your worst enemy, which can oftentimes be yourself. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And it's, well, I mean, emotion drives the market, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's what happens. So when you take out that emotion,
the market is not rational.
The market is not rational. Yeah. The market is not rational. So Annie, let me finish up and ask you, what do you see on a go forward basis with opportunity zones? I mean, if you were to say, look, if I look back on from 2018, I've been seeing things going forward, and this is where I think OZs either are going to continue to go or expand or whatever. What would you say?
Well, I think OZs are at a fork in the road, DJ. So one thing we haven't touched on is the fact that this is a perishable tax incentive. And currently, we're already about halfway through that total runway. You can only achieve the tax benefits of investing in qualified opportunity funds if you roll over a gain that is accrued through December 31, 2026, which means we're in February, late February of 2023. You only have, less than 4 years now to accrue a capital gain that would be eligible to invest into an opportunity zone funds. And the tax incentive has been around for four and a half years now. So we're about halfway done with this. So what I've heard anecdotally, I've heard two different narratives tugging on different ends of the rope. One is, hey, opportunity zones are raising a ton of capital. And actually, despite the market downturn in 2022, it was the best year for equity raising for opportunity zones ever. Now, I will say, I'll caveat that by saying that the vast majority of the fundraising happened in the first 6 months of the year. Because when the market started to tank, we saw fewer and fewer transactions into OZs in the latter half of the year. But still, there is a lot more familiarity with the program. The final regs have been out now for a couple of years. We're past COVID. We've got a little bit of market turbulence, admittedly. We've got high inflation, interest rates on the rise. It seems like there's always something that's kind of getting in the way of this thing really going. But there's a little bit of momentum, at least, happening for opportunity zones. Now, on the other end of the rope, there's this narrative that says, hey, every day that goes by, this tax incentive becomes less and less valuable. And that is true. Yeah. Because one of we didn't really go over the tax benefits because I think a lot of your viewers and listeners are familiar with this already. But the first tax benefit is that you get to defer capital gain recognition on your investment until the end of 2026. So each day that goes by, you're one day closer to that deferment date. So if you make an investment in 2026, you're not actually taking advantage of that benefit at all. Now, the main benefit, getting to escape or eliminate capital gains liability after achieving a 10-year hold period within the opportunity zone investment, that's still very much around. But getting back to that matter of that narrative that's tugging on the other end of the rope, we are getting closer and closer to that point in time where opportunity zones are set to expire. So the fork in the road now, DJ, is I think there's one of two roads that the opportunity zones policy can go down, and it's largely up to Congress. In fact, I would say it's entirely up to Congress to decide what to do with the program. There is some legislation that was introduced last year that would extend the Opportunity Zones program by an additional 2 years. And I think that would give Opportunity Zones a huge push down the path I want Opportunity Zones to take, is the path down which Opportunity Zones continue to be in existence for years and years to come. And hopefully that's the first step in eventually making Opportunity Zones permanent.
Yeah.
Because if the program is really doing what it's intending to do, if it really there's no reason to stop it. So Congress, it's entirely up to Congress. It does require an act of Congress to amend the statute such that it does get extended by 2 years, 3 years, maybe eventually it's permanent. Now, if Congress doesn't take action, unfortunately, I think Opportunity Zones goes down that other road where as each day goes on, the tax incentives become less and less important, and eventually it will expire at the end of 2026, and then opportunity zones will be no more, unfortunately. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Congress takes action at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, and passes some reform legislation that would extend opportunity zones for years to come.
All right. So this is what we're going to do, because this, like you said, I mean, this is a whole nother topic we haven't even got into. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get you right back on the docket so we can continue this conversation.
Well, because let's do it.
It's something that, you know, is, and I didn't even think of what you were saying about 26. I mean, it's coming fast. We're already into March,
yeah.
You know, and it's going to be here before we know it. So, Jimmy, thank you so much. Jimmy Atkinson with Opportunity DP and your new wealth channel, which congrats on that, which is great. And looking forward to seeing that expand as well. But thanks for being on the show, Family Office Real Estate Insights. Like I said, we're going to continue this conversation at a later date for sure. So we'll make sure that we have anybody that's listening, you know, look out for this one, because I know this is going to be a very, very important topic. So, Jimmy, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, DJ.